Any more AA-related announcements? No? All right. Then I'll turn the meeting over to Chris.
Good evening, everybody. My name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Coming in here, Bill stopped me and he goes, "Did you see the hail?" And he took me outside and there was hail the size of quarters all over the place. It was like 95 degrees 10 minutes ago. And now it's in the 60s or something. I think the end of the world is coming or something. This weather is crazy. Tonight I'm going to be talking a little bit on steps 4, 5, and 6. I want to recap steps 1 through 3 real quick, though, just to kind of get in the space for step 4. In step 1, I allow my experience to bring me to my truth as far as powerlessness is concerned. Our book says lack of power is our dilemma. I wanted it to be anything else. It was very, very difficult for me to conclude that power was my dilemma. I thought when I first went to rehab and when I started to go to AA meetings that lack of education was my dilemma. If only I could learn exactly what I need to do or learn a little bit more about alcoholism or learn a little bit more about my triggers or, you know, learn a little bit more about what happens when you slip, I could prevent my own relapse. I could thereby gain a little bit of power from self-will as far as my drinking is concerned. But I learned from a relapse and I learned from further experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that the first step basically is that I have a mind that's going to send me back to alcohol. I don't have an adequate defense against the first drink with my own unaided will. Trying to fight alcoholism and alcohol myself, I don't stand a chance. The time and the place will come and I will put alcohol back in my body. And because I'm alcoholic, I get what is known as the phenomenon of craving. And that's one drink always does something to me, and that's asks for a second drink. Second drink always insists on the third drink. The third drink always demands the fourth drink. And it's a very, very rare time indeed that I don't drink myself into a blackout and unconscious. That's how my alcoholism works. So I have a mind that will put me back to the bottle. Even if I don't want to, even if I know it's a terrible idea, even if the consequences are grave, I'll go back to alcohol with the power I have. My body being alcoholic will ensure that I die from drinking because the craving, it's like a craving for poison. I'll drink so much that it'll affect my organs, it'll affect my thinking, I'll crash cars, I'll get in fights with somebody that'll kill me. There's a million ways that I could die drinking the way I drink. I'm a page 21 alcoholic myself. I get dangerously antisocial. I'm the Jekyll and Hyde drinker. So it's not a good thing. I knew 10 years before I stopped drinking that it was a bad idea for me to drink. I just was not able to separate from the alcohol. The third part of step one is the unmanageability. And I believed for a long time in AA the unmanageability was the crash cars. I had a lot of them. The lost jobs, I had a lot of those. The horrible relationships with, you know, psychotics. I remember my sponsor told me one time, he said, "Chris, there could be a gymnasium filled with women, and somewhere in that gymnasium there'll be an axe murderer. And what the cops will do is they'll let you loose in there, and as soon as you become attracted to somebody, they'll throw the cuffs on her." You know, so that was my sponsor's relationship advice back in my first year when I said, "Gee, Phil, I think it's time for me to start dating." He had that look, you know, the look the sponsors give you, like this horrified expression, like, "Oh, my God, no." So, and the people I was hanging out with, I went from, you know, hanging out with my high school buddies, and some of them were actually rational. Some of them, you know, went on to lead very, very good lives. But the more I drank, the lower the denominator of my companions. And it got to the point at the end where they didn't even really have names. They were like Weezer and Green Man, you know, and they would always talk about their parole officers and stuff. You know, it was like, I used to think that was the unmanageability, you know. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and emotionally I'm a basket case. I identify with the newcomer that is shattered. You know what I mean? Just emotionally shattered, just, you know, a bundle of self-centered fear and anxiety and repressed anger and guilt and remorse. I mean, I identify so strongly with that because that's all I was. I was a walking ball of emotion, and I was just trying to hold it all in. And I started to become educated to the fact that that had a lot more to do with my unmanageability than the results of my drinking, the ramifications of drinking the way I did. So the first step is basically saying you have a mind that's going to send you back to drink, your body's going to ensure that you die drinking, and your life is going to be total shit while it all goes on. Welcome. You know what I mean? Welcome to AA. The first step, you can't come out of the first step feeling good about yourself. It's not like, I've just figured out I'm alcoholic. You know, let's have a gratitude meeting. I mean, you know, that's not somebody that's come to the actual conclusion of alcoholism. Alcoholism is a progressively fatal malady that step two and some of the other steps say, you know, you need a conscious relationship with God to have a chance at survival. So in step two, step one says lack of power is my dilemma. I don't have the power to prevent my own relapse. I don't have the power to manage my own life with any kind of quality as an untreated alcoholic. Step two says that you can come to believe that there's a power. There is a power out there that you can tap into that not only will keep you safe and protected from the first drink, but allow you to, in the words of the big book, recreate your life. There's a terminology in the big book that talks about being reborn. We were reborn. And I don't mean that in the fundamentalist Christian type of way. Being reborn, I've been reborn. I'm not the same guy that was hanging around with Weezer and Green Man. You know, there's some really good things going on in my life today. So there is a power that you can tap into. The experience, the accumulated experience of Alcoholics Anonymous will show you that. There's millions of recoveries in Alcoholics Anonymous. And certainly a large proportion of those people are true, page 21, alcoholics. So there is a solution, there is a power that you can tap into. That's basically step two. Step three is, okay, I know I'm an alcoholic now, and I know what that means and what that looks like. I do believe that there is a power that could relieve me of my alcoholism. What do I need to do? Step three basically says, are you in or are you out? Are you going to engage in the process of recovery as earlier AAs have experienced it? And hopefully, the answer is yes. A lot of people misunderstand the third step, and they think it's turning your will and your life over to the care of God, and you're going to be selling flowers with the Moonies in the airport in 2 or 3 weeks. You're sure of that, you know? That's really not the case. At its simplest, step three is saying that you're going to make a decision to go through the rest of the steps, steps 4 through 12, become of service in step 12, and you're going to define a little bit better your relationship with God. And there's a lot of latitude in those definitions. Basically, the book says that God is going to be looked on by us as a father figure. And we're going to play the role of the child. God is going to play the role of the principal, and we're going to play the role of the agent. And God is going to be our director, and that means we're to seek direction from God. And that, believe me, that leaves enough latitude for practically any religion or spiritual belief to fit in there. So it's non-discriminatory. It's all inclusive. It's never exclusive or forbidding. It's just a decision to try that stuff. One of the things it says in How It Works is no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. So basically what that says is none of us have even come close to maintaining all of these spiritual principles. So often in Alcoholics Anonymous, you get the result of it from a serious effort. So okay, I'm with all three of the first three steps. I'm an alcoholic. I believe there's a power that could. I believe I will engage in whatever process I need to capture that power, to engage that power so that my life can be recreated and I can stay separated from alcohol. Some of the 10 steps promises really speak very, very clearly to where we're going to be with alcohol after the spiritual recovery process. We're going to be safe and protected. We're going to be in a position of neutrality. We're going to think sanely and normally about alcohol. And that's really what I need, because being an alcoholic, the time and the place can come and I can drink again. And if anybody in here has had periods of sobriety and went back to booze, anybody in here have like 2 or 3 years or something? You know that you get slingshotted back into that active alcoholism. It's almost worse to quit for a period of time than it would have been if you just would have kept on. It's amazing how the liver and the pancreas and the other organs that metabolize alcohol continue to be damaged and continue to cause the physical problems of alcoholism, even when you're not drinking. Somebody I admired very, very much from speaker tapes and workshops came to the conclusion that they had been away from alcohol so long that every single cell in their body had a chance to completely become new. There's a biological theory that every single cell in your body after like 3 or 5 years is completely changed and completely rebuilt. So he thought that since all of his cells were rebuilt, he might not be alcoholic and he might try some controlled drinking. I don't know how that experiment is going, but if I was a gambling man, I'd bet that it's not going to end pretty, however long it might last. I'll tell you, alcoholism is rough. All right, we've made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. We've made a decision to engage in this recovery process. What are we going to do? The book tells us that we start with a searching and fearless moral inventory. Bill Wilson understood the English language, and sometimes you get in trouble with understanding what he was saying because he also didn't believe in saying the same word twice if there was something synonymous with those terms. So you're going to see a lot of terms that generally mean the same thing. Like you'll have whole meetings with people discussing the difference between shortcomings and character defects. You know, he was saying basically the same thing because that's how he was taught to write. But a moral inventory, what he was basically saying, if you check out some of the earlier dictionaries from the mid-30s, what he was saying was truthful, just a very, very truthful inventory. If he meant, you know, every single little dirty secret, he would have said an amoral inventory. So a moral inventory, and where do we start? What are some of our biggest problems? Anybody in here remember the last year or two of drinking or the first year of sobriety? You ever have any resentments? You ever pissed off at anybody? I don't know about you. I changed home groups two or three times because, God damn it, if I'm going to have to hear that son of a bitch share one more time, I got to hear that crap one more time from that hypocritical bastard. I'm gonna kill myself. Why doesn't he just shut up? Why doesn't he shut up and just drink? And that was me in my first 6 months. You know, Mr. Unity, Mr. Recovery. I remember going up to this one guy, and he was. I hated this. Somebody that would come in and they'd be happy in 2 days. You ever see like that? You know, I was in you know, bitter struggle for like my first 12 months, just hanging on by a thread. And somebody comes in and like the first week they're happy. I wanted to kill them. And this guy became the greeter at like every meeting I went to. So it would be like going through the gauntlet. You know, I'd have to shake this guy, say, "Hey, how you doing? I'm the so-and-so. Welcome to AA." You know, and finally I pulled him aside and I said, "Listen, you're killing newcomers." And he goes, "What?" I go, "Think of it this way. You are such a weenie that if some new guy has to make it through you to get into the AA meeting, they're just going to turn around and go back out there and get drunk and die. You gotta stop doing this." And he immediately had to have a sponsor summit meeting with his sponsor about this whole thing, if you can imagine. And sponsor, "Oh, that's Chris. Chris is crazy. Don't listen to anything he says. Good God." So, you know, anybody have resentments in early recovery or toward the end of your drinking? I mean, I kept a list. You know what I mean? People that I was going to get even with. So here's the thing about resentments. It's like drinking poison and expecting somebody else to die. You're slowly eroding your emotional condition with these resentments. You have no peace of mind when people are taking up your thought process with like revenge and hate and resentment. It's it really is a corrosive thought process, this resentment. You can't just wish him away, though. I mean, you can't just say, "Well, I don't think I'll have any more resentments." And the real wonderful thing about this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, which I don't read very much from, but I'm hopefully speaking about, the wonderful thing about it is they recognized how damaging these resentments were. And they realized the process or an adequate process for the resentment's removal. Now, a thing about a spiritual process is when you're standing in front of it, you just don't understand it. You don't have a lot of faith. You can have some belief, but you don't have a lot of faith. I'm thinking about why I did my first four step. I think it had a lot to do with my sponsor, Phil, saying, "Chris, it's time that I really think you should start doing your four step." And he had said it to me about 30 times over a 3 or 4 month period. So I kind of started to get the idea that he might have been serious about it. I wanted to do it because I thought it would give me legitimacy in Alcoholics Anonymous and there would be more meetings that I could share in, you know, with status. You know, I'd hate to be like, you know, in a four-step meeting and not have done my four-step and, you know, share. Like, "Well, I really haven't done my four-step. Let me tell you a little bit about today." And everybody would look at you like, "Shut up." So listen, this was great. This only happened to me once, but there was this great, crusty, cranky old-timer in one of the first meetings I went to. And whenever somebody just starts sharing about their day and about Aunt Fanny and Uncle Fudd and, you know, how their kids are disrespectful and, you know, he would go, "Tell somebody who cares." He'd like yell that out. It was just beautiful, I swear. Everybody was thinking it, but this one guy, he was so old he didn't care, you know. He was praying, "Tell somebody who cares." Anyway, I don't know why I got off on that, Dave. Anyway, the reasons why I did the four-step were not the best of reasons. The great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is we don't care what your reasons are. We really don't want to get involved too much in your thought process. Thank you. You know, if you haven't done the steps yet, we'll patronize you a little bit, but we really don't want what you have prior to going through the steps, regardless of what you might think. We're nothing if not truthful here, right, Dave? He made me say that. Anyway, so here I am. I'm doing the four-step for wrong motives, but I got some stuff out of it. My first trip through the four-step, I was not exposed to an adequate presentation of the recovery process. There's in the book, As Bill Sees It, he states that the sponsor's responsibility is an adequate presentation of the 12-step process to the sponsee. And I believe that today. And my sponsors never had an adequate presentation of the 12 steps. So they couldn't give me something that they didn't have. I'm talking about back in the early 90s. So it wasn't unusual to raise your hand in a four-step meeting and say something like, how exactly do you do this? And to have somebody share after you and say, kid, you do a four-step with a pencil. Well, thanks for that. You know, that's helpful. And I slowly learned that, you know, they really didn't have much of a clue on how to do a four-step. Didn't matter that they had 20 years. It just wasn't a big thing back in the 70s and the 80s. So anyway, I did this crazy conglomeration of stuff. I opened up the step book. I went to like 25 four-step meetings. I found out where they all were. I was about to do a four-step, so I started going to four-step meetings. I mean, you want to get confused? Go to 12 and 12 four-step meetings. You know, the seven deadly sins, and, you know, I'm a glutton. And it's just going to probably confuse you, as it did me. So I came away from this thinking, okay, I've got to write down a list of all the dirty, rotten little things that I'd done. I'm going to do a life story, and I'm going to write down maybe some patterns and some character defects that I might have, like that I've recognized. So I really didn't learn anything from my first four-step. It was more confessional. It was more writing down the things that that I had never had the nerve to tell somebody. And that's not really what a four-step is, but I got what you get from that type of a four-step. It was confessional. There was a burden that was lifted off of me by doing that, because it probably was the first time I was ever completely honest with an individual. And that goes a long way for making you feel a lot better. So I walked away. I remember walking away from the fifth step feeling like, you know, I'm not such a dirtbag after all. I think there might be something redeeming about me. I had a horrible self-esteem back in the day. You know, you do things that we do when we're drinking, and it's going to erode your self-esteem, because, you know, we're not evil people. We're just sick people. So anyway, my second four-step, I had been exposed to a more accurate mechanical process for the four-step. I had gotten a hold of some tapes from some guys from Arkansas, and it was difficult for me to really buy into a set of tapes from people from Arkansas, being a little bit prejudiced and closed-minded, but I listened to them because it was a long ride to work, and I did find these guys interesting. And what they did was they exposed me to the mechanics of the four-step, the resentment inventory, which is basically people, places, institutions with whom you were angry or resentful. Column number one. Column number two, why were you angry? What exactly did they do? Column number three, seven areas of self: financial security, sexual relations, personal relations, pride, self-esteem, areas like that. Write down how this resentment affects you in those areas. Because I'll tell you, you can't be mad at somebody unless they harm, threaten, or interfere with something you have or something you want to get. an instinct, something you want to hang on to, or an ambition, something you want to get. You just can't be mad at somebody unless something is harmed, threatened, or interfered with. So in column number 3, I need to identify that. And in column number 4, there's a line of demarcation. There's some prayer work that needs to be done before you move on to column number 4. And that's where you identify, where have you been selfish? Where have you been dishonest? Where have you been self-seeking? And where have you been afraid? Where have you been motivated by fear or self-centered fear? So to the best of my ability, I did that. I had, 50 or 80 resentments. If it walked, I hated it usually, being an alcoholic. I put all that down. Second part of the inventory is a fear inventory. First time I did a fear inventory, all I did was write down the fears. The mechanics that the big book explains to us is basically name the fear and why do you have the fear? Where's it come from? Some of the questions they ask you to ask are, isn't it because self-reliance has failed you? And where I finally got to with the fear inventory, after a couple of fear inventories, where I finally got to is this. In step 3, I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, or my thinking, my actions over to the care of God as I understand him. I try to develop the father-child, principal-agent, director, actor type of part of my relationship, and I am definitely making a decision to seek God's will and to help other people. That's inherent in every prayer in the big book. Third step prayer, seventh step prayer. It's all inherent in those prayers that if God is gonna relieve me of these things, it's gonna be because I'm gonna be doing his work. So if I've made a decision to be on God's team, what the hell is going to get through to me that isn't going to be in my best interest somehow? And I came to that conclusion during one of my fear inventories, and all of a sudden, so much of the anxiety, so much of the fear that I had was just lifted, because slowly self-reliance started to be pushed aside for God-reliance. The more God-reliant you are, the more fearless you are. The more capable you are, the more abilities you can put into play. It's just amazing. So that's what the fear inventory has done for me. Does that mean that fears don't crop up? Does that mean that resentments don't crop up? Oh, please. Every single one of us falls short in word, thought, and deed every single day. Every single day. We are not saints. If there was a saint, the last place they'd be is in Alcoholics Anonymous, for God's sake, They'd be heading up some new church with 400,000 members that makes $12 billion an hour. So we're not saints. We're all, and you know what? I don't even want to be perfect. It's not about trying to be perfect. I don't like perfect people. You want to know something? Want to know what makes us lovable? Our imperfections, not our perfections. Nobody likes somebody that's perfect. Or trying to be perfect, or acting perfect, or thinking they're perfect. So it's not about being perfect. It's about applying principles to the difficulties that you have having relationships with people and God and yourself and everything else. Next part of the fourth step is harms to others, emphasis on sex. I don't know about anybody else, but I botched up sexual relations in my day, I'll tell you. I would take hostages. The people that were especially attracted to me were the Al-Anon type women. If you come from an alcoholic family, I remember my first wife. Both her father and mother and all her brothers were alcoholic. So dating Chris was like going home. You know what I mean? And there was an attraction to the alcoholic dysfunction that I was manifesting in my life. You know what I mean? There was kind of a thrill about going to the impound lot and helping me get the crashed car out, or bailing me out one more time and then calling up all her friends and saying, I had to bail Chris out again, And there was something, it was exciting, It was excitement. If I was a data processing entry person, it probably wouldn't have been that. Oh, sorry. Probably, I forgot you were here, Rick. Anyway, you know what I'm saying. I mean, I was a nut out there, and there was it was not dull being around me. But as my alcoholism progressed, my relationships got more and more bizarre. I ended up with this one woman from a California motorcycle club who wanted to be armed all the time. Spent almost all of her adult life in prison. That's kind of how I met her, through this prison pen pal thing. Somebody I knew was in this prison and met her and said, "Oh, you'd like her, you know." Okay, I'll start writing her. I'm single at the present time, and she moved from Texas, where she was in a Supermax facility or something, up to New Jersey, where I was living with my mom, and moved in with me and mom. There was some turbulence in the household at that period of time. I have to tell you, wasn't a good idea. Looking back on it, I can say that. She would steal cars. I mean, I live in Basking Ridge, And she would change license plates, she'd steal them off of other cars. And it just wasn't right, Basking Ridge. This one time, I'm drinking with her in the Store restaurant in Basking Ridge. Anybody know the Store restaurant? Yeah, that is the most sedate, classy type of establishment. It's not a shot and beer joint, you know what I'm saying? And I take her up there for a drink, and I don't know why I said this. I said, we're in conversation. See the waitress over there? I go, we were partying one night, and she said she'd go out with me. And, I called her up like 3 times, and she blew me off every time. I don't even know why I said this, but she had this, honor thing. And that I wasn't really aware of. And so we go walking out to the car, and she goes, "Hold on a minute, I left my purse inside." She goes back inside. It's about 3 or 4 minutes. All of a sudden, she's running out the door, full speed, just diving into the car. I go, "What the hell? What's the matter? Let's get out of here, let's get out of here." I go, "What did you do?" She goes, "You know that woman that disrespected you?" I go, "Yeah." She goes, "I dragged her off the bar stool, beat the shit out of her." I'm like, in the Store restaurant? There hasn't even been a fight between men in the Store restaurant in 50 years. I go, what did they do? She goes, "They just stood there and watched." So there was the bartender, everybody, they were just they were in shock. Oh, my God. So this is my girlfriend that's living with me and mom. Has my sex relations, is there problems there? It says in this book that many of us need an overhauling. Anybody out there familiar with mechanics? You know what an overhauling is? It's not a tune-up. It's like you strip the whole sumbitch right down to nothing, and you put it back together the right way. And that's a long process, but the sex inventory is basically 9 questions. You're to review the relationship. I ask the guys that I work with to do a paragraph or two on the relationship, what it was like, what happened, where is it now. And then there's 9 questions. They're like, did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy? Where did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where did I do that? Because if I'm an alcoholic, I did. Who did we hurt? What should we have done instead? A number of questions like that. And you answer all these. And then it asks you to shape a sane and sound ideal for your future sex life. Now, I was a little bit confused about this in the beginning. I thought it was like, what type of woman did I want? An all-female jazz band, maybe, or how about the Swiss ski team, female ski. But what it really is, it's the qualities that I want to bring to the party. What type of qualities do I want to bring to a relationship? Because it's a spiritual fact that you attract what you are. So So if you're healthy, if you're vibrant, if you know, you've got a lot of really good qualities going on, that's usually what you're going to attract. It's going to be a rare day that you get somebody from the prison pen pal program applying. You know what I mean? So that's what I ask everybody to do. You know, write it up. And that's the fourth step. Now, having put this fourth step together, what do you do with it? The book basically says that if you're of a religious persuasion that requires confession, you're supposed to bring that to the duly appointed representative. So if you're a practicing Catholic or something, our book basically says that you should go to a priest. Now, I think we've learned through accumulated experience over the years that it's also near vital that you do do a fifth step with a sponsor or a spiritual advisor, somebody that's going to see you through the rest of this work, somebody that's going to be tied into your, who's going to be invested in your spiritual growth and development. So there's another place in this that says person or persons who may hear your fifth step. So you don't need to just do it with one person. I've done a number of fifth steps. I've probably at least done eight of them. And during one of the, I did a multiple fifth step one time. Somebody's actually in here who was part of that. The poor guy had to endure. Paul, how many hours was that? Was like 20 hours. It went on and on and on. The poor, he was losing his mind. But he was my sponsee at that time, and I did it with another friend of mine and his sponsee, and we shared fifth steps. And I got to tell you, that was an amazing experience. That experience chopped my ego up. Kind of necessary to spiritual growth is deflation of ego, because it's the ego that tells you don't need spiritual growth. These people are full of crap. You know, that's the ego part of our mind that tells us those things. So ego deflation. Harry Tebow, one of the early psychological friends of ours in early AA development, talks about it a lot. There's some really good things online, and if you want to follow up further on that, I'm sure Bill could point you in the right direction for Dr. Tebow writings. But one of his main thrusts was deflation of ego at depth is necessary for surrender. And that particular multiple fifth step just beat the crap out of me. It did. I walked away. You know, up until moving into that, you know, I'm Chris Schroeder, Mr. AA. You know, we're doing workshops and sponsoring 30 or 40 people. And walking out of that fifth step, I felt like, you know, I was so damn human. It was just unbelievable. It really put me right size. So I'm not recommending that. I'm just saying that's an experience that the book says we can have if we want to, person or persons. I've done fifth steps with my sponsor. Obviously, I've done about four with my sponsor. I've done about four with other people. Pete is in here tonight. One of my favorite pieces of fifth step work I did with him in Solvang, California, sitting up on top of this unbelievably beautiful bluff, looking down over this incredible valley. Up in the California mountains. It was so special. They don't have any bugs out there, you know, so you can actually hang out outside. You get the crap eaten out of you around here if you want to sit outside too long at night. But it was beautiful. It was clear. It was no humidity. And it was just an absolutely special piece of fifth step work. I've done it with a number of different people. And each time I get a very, very centering experience. I get pulled back down to where I need to be, with my feet firmly planted on the earth. You know, I'm a spiritual being having a human experience, and it centers me. And that leads me to step six. After I've identified the character defects, after I've identified what's going on in my resentments, my self-centered fear, my guilt and remorse, all these things from my harms to others, and I've talked about them with somebody, I don't think, you know, it says in this book, go somewhere where you can be quiet for an hour and review your work up to that point. So I think that's a smart thing to do too. And I'm not saying every single time I did it for an hour, but I try to. And we're asked to see if all of our stones are in place. Have we held back on anything? Did we forget anything? Did we do a half-assed job? Or were we as thorough and as fearless as we could be at that time? And if the answer is yes, you move forward into step six. Step six is become willing to have God remove these defects of character. Now, in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, there's really only about a paragraph on this step. I believe there's a lot of depth to this step. I believe that you can really dig into what it's saying in that one paragraph, and you can spend a lifetime exploring the depths and the ramifications of step six, becoming willing to have God remove these defects of character. But when I have somebody going through an initial inventory, an initial fist up, we'll do this rather quickly. Basically for the reason that after you've identified your character defects and you've talked about them with somebody else, you're about as close to being willing to have the defects of character removed as you're going to be. I mean, you've had an experience. You've had a four-step experience, and you've had a fifth-step experience. So you've recognized that these defects of character have caused all of your problems. You'll no longer get upset in a step meeting where they talk about the spiritual axiom. Does anybody have a resentment toward the spiritual axiom when they were going through the step book the first time? You know, what does it say if you feel like there's a problem or something, there's something wrong with you? You know, I thought that was a typo. But, you know, here's something that needs to be corrected. Call the central office. You know, this can't possibly be true. It can't always be my problem. But even in the inventory section of this book, it says, we found our problems were of our own making. That's hard to get completely to. That's hard to completely internalize. I don't know that I've completely internalized that, because there's always going to be something that you're gonna think is not your fault. There's always going to be justified anger. Like, I know all this AA stuff. I know all this. But so-and-so did such and such. It was only about 5 years ago I had a justified resentment that near took me out, you know, and I had a lot of loving people around me helping me through that. You know, a couple of things had happened in the rooms to me that I just could not get past. And finally, through inventory and things like that, I was able to see that not only did I participate in it, but I set myself up for it. Now, there's a lot of freedom in that. There's a lot of freedom in that. Because here's the thing. If it really is their fault and they really are the problem, are they really going to change? Do you have any control really over them changing? So if it's the family and it's the boss and it's the cops and it's the landlord and it's all these people and it's really them you don't understand, can you get out of that? Because you can't really expect those people to change. When you can finally internalize that you've somehow set the stage for these resentments, somehow, there's light at the end of the tunnel. There's some freedom that can be had from that realization. Through the recovery process, we can get free. It's about freedom. So many people today in Alcoholics Anonymous just don't drink and go to meetings, and they're okay with that. Because it's not their experience, they haven't had a recovery experience, they don't even know it, but what they're settling for is relief, sometimes temporary relief. They're settling for relief when freedom is being offered through this recovery process. Freedom. And again, I said earlier in this meeting, as you stand before a spiritual recovery process, you're not going to understand it. You're not going to buy it. You're not going to be able to intellectualize it. It's not a theory. It's an experience. So again, I usually describe it like this. Two kids, 9, 10 years old, get really involved in Mount Everest and mountain climbing. They really get interested in it. And they're both twins. And one of them, as they become adolescents, one of them reads every book there is. They watch every movie. They go to the library. They read every book there is on mountaineering. They know Sir Edmund Hillary and all those other the Sherpas. And I mean, they can recite chapter and verse, the North Face, how you approach the mountain. And the other twin starts taking climbing lessons, starts getting involved in Outward Bound and going on adventure climbing, and eventually becomes the youngest summiter ever to reach the top of Mount Everest at like 17 or 18 years old. Now you have them both over at your house, and they're both talking about Mount Everest. Who would you ask if you wanted to know what the experience of climbing Mount Everest was like? Would you ask the person that learned about it intellectually, or would you ask the person who experienced it? I'd like to know what the experience was like. That's just more interesting and more valuable to me. So often what we learn in Alcoholics Anonymous is intellectual theorizing. I'm not saying all of it's bad. I think that there has to be some theories. There has to be some intellectualizing. We have to understand the mechanics. So there has to be some theorizing. If we don't understand the mechanics, it's going to be hard for us to even do the steps. But the fact of the matter is to quantify an experience is very, very difficult. It's very, very difficult. Somebody said it's like dancing to architecture. How do you do that? How do you explain to someone who's blind the color spectrum? It's difficult. It's something that the spiritual life needs to be experienced. So I've had an experience with step 5 and step 6. Now I become willing to have God remove all my character defects. Now I can fool myself on this a lot of times too. I can totally believe I'm completely willing to have God remove all my defects of character, every single one, until I really start to examine them. How about lust? How about putting that on the table for God to remove? I don't think so. If I do that, I may never get laid again. You know what I mean? That's not negotiable, that one. How about your job? How about your job? I mean, you're in a high-pressure job. You got to be a shark. It's a tough world out there. How about putting your aggressiveness and your arrogance on the table? I don't know if I'm willing yet. So again, there's levels of willingness, and as I go through the steps, more and more. Like I said, I've at least gone through them all 8 times, somewhere around 8 times. I believe I get to a place where I am more and more willing to hand up everything, more willing. Bill Wilson had learned a lot in the 13 years or so from when he wrote the Big Book to when he wrote the 12 and 12. There's a lot of good information in the 12 and 12 on step 4. 5, 6, 7, additional information. It's kind of like Bill's theories and Bill's understanding and Bill's perspective being separated from alcohol by 15 or 16 years and being involved in watching Alcoholics Anonymous grow and watching a lot of people do step work. So there's some additional information. I believe that no human being has been able to pin down the alcoholic personality as well as Bill Wilson. I mean, you read some of his writings in the 12 and 12 as Bill sees it, some of his grapevine articles. He had us pegged. He had us pegged. He with one sentence, he could just lay out, you know, your whole problem. He was a visionary. So a lot of his writings are very, very helpful. Very, very helpful. There's a great story that's also told a lot when it comes to step six. I believe this came out of Anthony DeMillo book or something. I don't remember. Anyway, there's this kid, 8 or 9 years old, starts to get a toothache. His tooth starts hurting. He knows that if he goes to his mother will break up some Bayer aspirin, give him some aspirin, and he'll be able to get to bed that night without a toothache. But there's a problem with that scenario. You know what the problem is? The next morning, she's going to be dialing up Dr. Mengele, the dentist. And he's going to be going in and seeing this torture artist. He's going to put hoses and cotton and drills, and his teeth are going to be smoking. And he knows he's going to walk out of there about 2 hours later with perfect teeth. Kid doesn't want perfect teeth. He just wants the pain to go away. So what happens? He suffers it out as long as he can. About midnight, he wakes his mother up and tells her he's got a toothache. And he gets the aspirin. Sure enough, about an hour later, he's asleep. And the next day, they're dialing up Mengele. That really speaks a lot to us and our relationships with our character defects. We don't want to be perfect. We just want the pain to go away. We just want the problems to stop. So we're going to go into step six at a certain level with a certain amount of enthusiasm. That's why I believe so strongly that you continue to practice the steps. You don't just go through them once. Usually the people that tell you go through the steps once and do 10, 11, and 12 to the best of your ability the rest of your life are people that have done that. I tried it that way for a while, and then I started going through the steps annually or biannually. And I'm not going to go back to just doing it once. I've gained so much value from the continued application of practicing these principles. You know, and again, if it says practice these principles, practice doesn't mean do it once. I mean, if you're going to go learn how to play golf and you're going to practice golf, you're not just going to go shoot one round of golf and quit. You're going to continue to practice it. And in the 12 and 12, it says many of us go in for annual or semi-annual house cleanings. That was basically speaking to people who are going to do steps 4 through 9 annually or semi-annually. So I believe in that process, because I believe each time I get a little bit closer to a level of serenity, closer to emotional health than I was the time before. I think my spiritual life will be over when people are throwing dirt on me and saying the last rites. You know, I really think that's when it's going to be over. I don't believe that it's a destination. I don't believe that it's something that I get to. I believe it's something I work toward. And the value is in the working toward, not the getting to. So I don't want to be perfect. So that means I can't be going into step six 100%. But I go in as deeply as I can. Another thing that it talks about in the 12 and 12 that I found very, very valuable is there's a concept in the 12 and 12 that says you don't have to wait until the shit hits the fan to start doing step work. You can actually preempt the shit hitting the fan. Anybody in here ever wait until it all falls apart and then it's time to write inventory? You know what I mean? You know, the relationship is blown up, you've lost the job. Oops, time to write inventory. Well, if you write inventory like 2 months before that, you might not have lost the job. You might not have, the relationship might not have self-exploded. So again, there's something to be said for discipline, developing a discipline for the step work, for the spiritual process. It's not easy. I don't always want to go home and write inventory. Oh boy, You know, I mean, it's a choice between a Seinfeld rerun and inventory. What do you think is going to win out most of the time? But I do get to, I do try to do this work to the best. I'm not even going to say to the best of my ability. I do try to do this work adequately. I do try to do this work. Okay, I'll put it that way.
That was close.
Dave is moving away from me so he doesn't get hit by the lightning. Oh man. So anyway, rigorous honesty is demanded in this spiritual program, as you can tell. So become willing to have God remove these defects of character. Anybody in here ever work on their character defects? I did. I mean, my first time through, I stopped after step five, the first time I did that hodgepodge inventory, I stopped between step five and step eight and nine to work on my character defects. I was going to work on them. That, I got to tell you, it's like one of those clowns that pop back up after you hit it. I mean, I really got nowhere. Okay, today I'm working on my selfishness. I'm not going to be selfish at all. Give me that. You know, I mean, I'd last about 5 minutes. Or I'm not going to be judgmental. I'm not going to be judgmental. I'm not going to be judgmental. Look at that horse's ass over there. I was powerless over the manifestations of these character defects. So I believe today that there's my part and there's God's part. Just touching on step seven a little bit. And why I'm quoting the 12 and 12 so much tonight, I have no idea. But there's a great quote in the 12 and 12, and it says, God is not going to render us white as snow without our cooperation. And it's talking about step six and step seven. So one of the exercises that I do, and one of the exercises I get my guys to do when they're in steps six and seven, is to do a meditative practice for 30 days and ask this question and then meditate on it. How then shall I participate? So if God is not going to remove my character defects unless I participate, how then shall I participate? I'm going to leave it there for tonight, and we've got about 5 or 8 minutes left. We'll call on hands.
Ain't getting out of it that easy. Any questions, comments? No? Everybody's timer popped? Well, then we can thank Chris again for sharing his experience, strength, and hope, and we have a nice way of closing.